This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, citizens battle state laws which grant immunity to polluters. We talk green about international family planning. Another response to a listener question about genetically engineered soybeans. And in the Earth calendar, turtles are waking up in the southeast and are looking for water. These stories and more coming up this week on the Environment Show. Across the country, state legislatures are passing a new type of environmental law called environmental audit statutes. These laws provide that if a company files an environmental audit, some information it supplies becomes privileged or secret. And if it admits in the audit to certain environmental violations, it gets immunity from prosecution. Audit laws vary from state to state. Kevin Williams is the field organizer for the Western Organization of Resource Councils. His group is organizing opposition to environmental audit laws, which he feels violate basic democratic principles.
This is really about people's right to know about what kind of pollutants are being, you know, dumped in their communities. That people have a right to know if corporations are violating the law, and that these laws fundamentally undermine that right. Secondly, that corporations deserve to be fined and punished if they break the law. We're talking about illegal conduct here. Polluters cost society billions of dollars. We all know that if we break the law, we have to pay the price, and corporations should do the same.
Of particular concern has been the environmental audit bill in Idaho, passed for a two-year period and scheduled to sunset this year. Sue Duncan, from Burley, Idaho, has been an opponent of the secrecy which she says environmental audit legislation provides.
We have a family farm of 1,000 acres. We grow the potatoes, sugar beets, and grain. We do a fairly good living and want to continue that. Just a few miles from our farm here where we live, we were faced with the situation of a private developer coming in. This developer wanted to bring in outside waste with this landfill that he was proposing to develop just a few miles from our farm. And then I had found out just 2 years ago the state of Idaho was looking at passing an environmental audit bill.
Susan Duncan and her neighbors with the Idaho Rural Council are hopeful that the current statute will not be reenacted. Fighting the privilege and immunity provisions of state environmental audit bills, citizens groups are asking the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to withdraw the power and the money it has given to states to enforce federal environmental laws. Dave Altman, an environmental lawyer from Cincinnati, Ohio, explains why he has petitioned the U.S. EPA to take action against Ohio.
The Ohio law makes secret basic factual information that would otherwise be available to the U.S. EPA. And because the Ohio EPA has made this deal that it will allow companies to keep this secret, this full information secret, they cannot basically do any of the things from investigate to remediate to develop proper penalties under federal law. So it's a backdoor deregulation just simply backdoor changes the federal law and guts it.
Currently, the EPA is reviewing citizens' petitions against state audit legislation from Ohio, Idaho, Colorado, Michigan, and Texas. Bertram Fry, deputy regional counsel with the U.S. EPA in Chicago, has real concern over both privilege and immunity provisions of state law because they can upset the equal application of environmental standards which federal law requires.
It's a key federal role, again, to set this level playing field across the country. So the environmental protection is the same. A baseline of environmental protection is the same for each citizen of this country, so that their health and welfare and the health and welfare of the environment are protected. So that's a key federal role. And it also extends to civil penalties insofar as that promotes a level playing field economically across the country, so that a violating competitor in one state doesn't get an economic advantage over a complying competitor in that state or another state.
state officials have differing views about audit statutes, particularly as the laws differ from state to state. In Colorado, Patty Schwader, who is the state director of public health and environment, thinks their law is working well. She says the privileges and immunities which it confers are limited.
It cannot be used as a shield for things that we would have found otherwise, and it also can't be used for things that are generally required by permit or order. So only in limited circumstances do we give immunity from fines and penalties. We have seen long-term benefit. We require in our law that you can't just come in and tell us about a problem. You have to fix it, and you have to work with us to fix it as quickly as possible. And, of course, we're monitoring that to see if it's going to work. I don't know of any environmentalist, any instance where anyone, frankly, has been prevented from obtaining information resulting from the reports made under the audits or disclosure. So what we are saying is watch how this thing works. Try and move aside the philosophy and the old command and control process and look at the outcomes, look at the results. And so far from our state, we've seen nothing but positive outcomes.
The governor of Montana vetoed an environmental audit bill last year. Some say his former role as a prosecutor made him concerned about privilege and immunity provisions. But the bill has been reintroduced this year. Richard Parks from Gardner, Montana, and a member of the Northern Plains Resource Council, describes what fighting environmental audit legislation in state houses is all about.
It's like sort of like trying to housebreak a grizzly bear. You get clawed up a bunch, the house gets trashed, and the bear just keeps on dumping in the middle of the living room.
As more and more states consider environmental audit legislation which grants privileges and immunities, conflict will continue. The players, which may be differently arrayed state by state, are the governors, the legislatures, the business and environmental lobbyists, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I'm Peter Burley. We're talking Green and the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we discuss U.S. funding of international family planning programs. President Clinton has reported that the delay of funding, which was imposed by Congress, has created irreversible, avoidable, and serious harm. His report triggered a process requiring Congress to vote on whether more money should be released. The House has already done so, but the issue is in bitter dispute. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Joining us today are three experts. Diane Dillon Ridgely, who is president of a nonprofit group called Zero Population Growth, based in Washington, D.C. At the moment, she's in El Paso, so we speak to her from there. Also with us is Aileen Gelbart, who is director of international programs at the Population Reference Bureau, and Margaret Pollock, who is director of the Office of Population at the United States Department of State. So, Margaret Pollock, let's start with you. What has been the impact of cutting of U.S. family planning aid?
Well, in a nutshell, what will happen is at least 17 programs administered by AID and amounting to at least $35 million would be seriously impacted by this four-month funding delay. As a result, there will be unintended pregnancies. Unintended pregnancies will rise, maternal deaths will become more numerous, and abortions will increase.
And, Margaret, let me ask you whether your conclusions follow that finding. When you've cut back funding, does it indeed have an immediate impact on birth rates?
Oh, absolutely. And I think even Diane and Aileen can certainly speak more dramatically to that, but that's clearly well-documented in much of the international data. Even a four-month delay for some might not seem to be that long, we have concluded will indeed have a very serious impact in terms of the increased in unintended pregnancies and the consequential maternal death.
And again, back to you, Margaret, since you run the program, how do you measure the exact impact? I mean, you know the money stops, but how do you know that birth rates go up?
Well, it's a very complicated process. I think, actually, I'll defer that to perhaps Aileen, who has done quite a bit of research at the Population Reference Bureau. and some of their documents and so forth that have supported this. We've actually used quite a bit of their documentation, their data, to support our finding.
And, Diane, you are an advocate here, and I want to go directly to the questions, and I have an email message sitting in front of me. And it says, why should the U.S. spend money on programs that offend the moral consciousness of some Americans and whose effectiveness is doubtful? How do you respond to that question?
Well, I think it's important to dissect what is asking that question. First of all, you should understand, and I think most people should understand, that we have years of surveys that say most Americans support U.S. efforts to expand access to family planning abroad, because the goal is, and nothing in this is or has ever been coercive. I mean, it's really important to stress this is all in terms of voluntary distribution of information and helping people have access to services that they want. And there are an estimated 120 million women who do not want to become pregnant currently, who have no access or have inadequate access to safe and effective contraception. Our goal, and I think as a bottom line, as a nation, has been to help people have the number and spacing of children that they want. That is both in the, I mean, it's a humanitarian response on our part, and it is also something that is in the long-term best interest of the United States and of everyone around the world.
Could I add something to that, Diane? I agree completely with what you said. It's also important to note that in any country in the world, regardless of their religion or culture, more educated women have fewer and healthier children than less educated women. So it's also an issue of equity, of giving women who have less education or less means to carry out their own decisions the opportunity to do so.
Margaret, let's go back to you for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government is making funds available to private groups that assist in family planning. How do you know, or how do you decide who gets the money and whether it's effectively spent?
Well, it's a very complicated but a contractual basis in which we have with private organizations, what we call non-governmental organizations or private voluntary organizations. It's one that's very, as I said, very detailed. It's clearly we monitor it and making sure that indeed none of these funds, we are legally prohibited and have been for since 1973 from using any USAID funds to fund abortion-related activities. And we monitor that particular area very closely. Clearly, we don't want to be in violation of U.S. law.
And that, indeed, is where a lot of the political dispute comes in the U.S., isn't it?
That's
people
correct.
People confuse this with the issue of whether we're funding abortions, and, of course, the law prohibits that.
The law prohibits that and has for over 25 years.
That's right. I think I really want to underscore that. For over 25 years, that has been the case, and it really is a red herring to try and throw that into this situation.
And yet, Diane, there has not been a debate in the Congress when that issue hasn't come up, has there? And this just seems to be a perennial issue politically.
Well, it's a perennial. I really use the term red herring because I must confess I'm tired of this.
Okay, look, let's go to the phones. We've got a call from the state of Washington, clear across the country. John Geckler, you're talking green on the Environment Show. Hello?
Well, I want to say that there are three primary reasons that I would argue for this funding. I think the humanitarian aspect has been touched on. I would add one thing in addition to maternal deaths and abortions, and that is that World Bank estimates something like 850,000 children under age 5 could be prevented from dying every year just if couples who wanted to avoid pregnancy had the means to do so through the family planning materials. It's clearly an environmental issue because it's pretty basic that more people coming into the world need more food, more water, more fuel, and that results in deforestation and soil erosion and greenhouse gases and loss of biodiversity. And I'd also say that it's really in our national interest because it's a security issue. Increasing population is a major cause of environmental scarcity, and that increases conflict. If you look around the world, there are 30-plus wars going on, several dozen internal civil and ethnic conflicts. And population increase that scarcity, and those conflicts become more acute.
Well, thank you for your call. Again, Margaret Pollack, as administrator or an administrator, how much money are we really talking about here?
Well, for this fiscal year, we're talking a total of $385 million for population-related activities. Now, that's a slight increase from our fiscal year 96 allocation of $356 million. However, it's approximately a 35% decrease from what was an all-time high of approximately $535 million in fiscal year 1995.
And before we go to one other caller, what has happened to other countries' support for family planning programs abroad? I know the Japanese, for a while, made some substantial commitments. Have other countries also dropped their foreign aid as we have, or have they stayed in it?
Well, you're correct in terms of the Japanese increasing their commitments. I think they clearly see what the relationships are. Likewise, there have been some of the European countries who have increased their overall contribution to population-related programs. But what we often see in terms of U.S. leadership is countries watch us. And if we cut back, they are likely to do the same. If we increase, that also makes them more likely to try and keep up with the United States.
Okay, well, let's go back.
Peter, can I just
yes.
say one thing? Because I think there are two points. Is
Diane.
Sometimes when, yes, sometimes when we use the total amounts, those numbers are harder for people to put in a context. And the two things I'd say. One, the United States has had 30 years of U.S. support and leadership, especially to help developing countries provide voluntary family planning. And as Margaret said, that leadership globally has been instrumental in making the progress we've made. And secondly, if you make that in a context that I'm using here as a reference, the Rockefeller Foundation information, it's 25 cents out of every dollar spent on family planning services in developing countries. That is the combined amount from the United States and other donor countries. So we even are, I mean, the countries themselves are through those agencies and through the countries still providing three-quarters of the money that supports this. I think it helps to give a context.
Aileen, your organization tracks some of those figures, does it not?
Well, this is what we're hearing, that other countries, developed countries, are saying that they are in worse economic straits than the United States, and while they want to increase their commitment, they, as Margaret and Diana both said, they look to us for leadership. There is still some question about whether they will maintain the commitments that they informally made at Cairo. I can't remember that they put down specific dollar figures that they would follow through on. They had a similar situation that we had, where you had an administration saying one thing, and that has to be followed through by the rest of the government. And as we were discussing, that was not the case following Cairo in the United States. I think the leadership issue is important not only in terms of funding, but in terms of the kind of work that the United States government has supported. As Diane mentioned, we've been involved, this country's been involved for 30 years, and that has built up a cadre of expertise that, in terms of providing technical assistance, not only to developing countries in how to provide services that meet people's needs as they define them, which is what the world community has agreed is the best way to do all this.
But I want to go back to the phones, to Sally Ethelson. Sally, you're talking green.
Wonderful. It sounds as though the question I was asking has been answered, but there was another point that might be worth someone commenting on.
Sure.
Is in terms of the impact of this cut. I mean, whether or not the money is actually released to the program in March, there's still this roughly $200 million cut from 1995 through 1997 in terms of annual funding. And, of course, given that the U.S. is one of the biggest contributors of population assistance funds, doesn't this have a very significant impact on overall levels of funding on the part of donor countries?
So the real question, as I hear you asking it, is let's not get confused about whether we release some money in March or July. The fact is that we're substantially down from where we were 2 years ago. And what's going on here? What impact has this had?
This is Aileen. I'd like to say something to that effect in terms of the impact on health and well-being overseas. A year ago, a consortium of organizations, including our own, estimated that just the cuts alone, that doesn't include the delays and other funding mechanisms that have harmed the program, just the cuts would result, we're serving about 7 million would affect 7 million
right.
couples overseas, because as Diane said, we don't provide the bulk of support for family planning. We provide important seed money and resources to help countries do what they couldn't do otherwise. Those, in turn, those 7 million couples would experience 4 million unintended pregnancies.
Sally, thank you for your question. We've been joined by Diane Dillon Ridgely, president of Zero Population Growth, Aileen Gelbart, who is director of international programs at the Population Reference Bureau, and Margaret Pollock, who is the director of the Office of Population at the U.S. Department of State. We're talking green on the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Let's hear from you. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We welcome your questions. Just give us a call on our toll-free line. It's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can email us at envshow@aol.com or find us on the web at www.enn.com/envshow. Environment Show producer Stephanie Goichman.
Last week, in response to a question about the safety of genetically engineered soybeans, we spoke to one scientist who believes they can be hazardous to one's health and the environment. Today, we hear a different point of view from Jack Widholm, a scientist in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois.
I don't think there's any danger from this kind of work, and in this case in particular. One thing that people do worry about is that maybe we'll pass these genes on to other plants, like weeds. Well, soybean does not cross with any weeds here in the Midwest at all, so there's really no danger of that. And I guess, all in all, I think these kind of biotechnological applications are useful and will actually help the farmer and improve food production. That's my opinion.
If you have a question about the environment, give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN, and we'll do our best to find an answer. I'm Stephanie Goichman.
Stay with us. The Earth Calendar is up next. Winter is fading fast in the southeastern U.S., and turtles and other water creatures are coming back to life. They spend the cold months buried in mud or soil waiting for the first warm rains of spring. Kurt Bullman is with the Savannah River Ecology Lab on the South Carolina-Georgia border.
Okay, right now it's, here in mid-February, we have warm spells that if we get good warm rains with them, it'll tend to bring out some of the amphibians and reptiles that have been somewhat dormant for the winter period. We don't get a, you know, real true hibernation sense in terms of for the reptiles down here. They tend to come out on warm days throughout the winter and will bask and so on. But generally, right at this time of the year, we do get start getting breeding aggregations of the various frog species and salamander species.
The Southeast has one of the highest concentrations of freshwater turtles in the world. Many of them live in seasonal wetlands, which are wet from now until the fall. Bullman says many turtles move from one wetland to another, spending a good portion of their time in the dry woodland areas around the wetlands. He says many of these areas are being filled in for development or agriculture, yet they're critical to the biodiversity of the area.
Down here on the South Carolina coastal plain, we have a number of seasonal wetlands. We call them Carolina Bays. They're really kind of an uncertain origin, but they're fairly old, like 10,000 to 40,000 years old. There are several turtle species that are also use these seasonal wetlands, and they leave the wetlands in the fall months when the water is draining down, and they go and they burrow in surrounding upland habitats. On a nice warm night here in the winter, you can hear quite a few species of frogs calling from any given pond.
Do turtles make any noise?
Turtles are fairly quiet.
Few places could be finer than the Southeast in spring. The air is mild and the land is lush. But come summer, these areas will be sizzling. Then it'll be time to follow the turtles and jump into the nearest Carolina pool. The life of the turtle may not sound exciting, but unlike our children, when it awakes, it's seen and not heard. This is the Environment Show. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, could your cat be a threat to wildlife? Scientists disagree, but some estimates put bird kills at 3 billion each year. We continue to talk green about bugs, from the Arizona desert to the Pacific rainforest. We go to Bhutan, where the king has decreed that gross national happiness is more important than gross national product. And the cicadas of Borneo provide the backdrop for a new work by the McLean Mix, musicians Priscilla and Barton McLean. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. If you've ever owned a cat, you know they sometimes give their owners gifts, like dead birds. The question for scientists is, are our cuddly, lovable cats contributing to a decline in bird populations? Cat lovers, brace yourself. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports that some are blaming cats for harming the environment.
In the old battle between cartoon characters, Tweety Bird and Sylvester, the dopey cat is always outsmarted by the bird. But this arrangement is the exception. Nationwide, there are about 60 million cats, and many of them are very good hunters.
Feline predation is a very significant problem now, and of greater concern is the fact that it will continue to increase and become a greater problem over time.
Daniel Evans is the executive director of the Point Reyes Bird Observatory north of San Francisco. He estimates that over 3 billion birds are killed by cats every year, an astounding number that many dispute. Dr. Gary Petronek is a professor of environmental studies at the Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. He says given the threats facing birds, like habitat loss, pesticide poisoning, and predation from other animals, cats do not constitute much of a threat.
Feline predation, for the most part, in the continental U.S., falls pretty low on the totem pole.
Dr. Petronek admits some cats do kill birds, and that in some places they can be a problem. But he questions how Evans arrived at his statistics.
The person that is writing it is basically sitting there and speculating, saying, well, how many cats are there in the United States? 50, 60 million. He's saying some of these never go outside 10%. Well, that's probably not true. I mean, we know, you know, from a number of surveys that perhaps 40% of all cats are indoor only. Then he says maybe another 10% are too old or too slow to catch anything. That leaves 44 million domestic cats hunting. And basically he's just guessing. I mean, he's saying it's impossible to know how many of these animals actively catch birds. And then comes up with this guesstimate of saying, well, 1 in 10 of those cats kills one bird a day, for a daily total of 4.4 million songbirds. Well, it's shocking, I agree, but what does that really mean? You know, it's not based on any data. It's just based on someone sort of sitting there and guesstimating, gee, if this was the case, this is what would happen.
Daniel Evans says it's impossible to fully quantify these statistics. Instead, he points out the obvious, that cats are natural killers or predators, and birds are particularly vulnerable. When you think about the numbers of cats in the U.S. alone, it doesn't take much to realize that there is a potential for cats to have a major impact on bird populations.
I would say these numbers are actually very conservative. All we have to do is look at the fact that cats were initially domesticated because of their effectiveness as predators. Thousands of years ago, we needed some way of keeping rats out of our houses, barns, and our granaries. And cats were the ideal solution. And cats were domesticated for no other reason initially than their abilities as a predator. And studies have shown that even though cats are well-fed, they are still instinctively very, very effective predators.
One of Evans's major concerns is the emergence of so-called feral cat colonies. These are places where communities of stray cats live. Sometimes it's in a wooded area near a park. Other times it's an abandoned house. Today, some cat lovers round the animals up, sterilize, and vaccinate them before releasing them back to their home. Evans says he feels for these animals, but says they are doing significant harm to the environment.
Feral cat colonies are basically dumping grounds for unwanted cats. People are refusing to take the true responsibility of stopping overpopulation of cats, and so the result is that it's much easier to find a place where we can keep these cats and pretend to be nice to them and feed them. And so very well-intended individuals are setting up places where these cats can be collected and fed and kept outdoors without really taking the full responsibility of finding them a home and stopping the bigger problem, which is simply over-reproduction of all of our domestic cats.
To an extent, Dr. Petronik agrees. He says cats do not fare very well outside. Instead, they should be kept inside. But there are some circumstances where cat colonies can be okay.
All cats probably are better off in their owner's home or supervised when they're outside. I think, you know, in terms of accidents, diseases, running away and never being found, cats are domestic pets and they probably do belong in the home. So I'm not advocating that they should be allowed out where they can, in fact, damage wildlife. And so, again, we have to realize that there are probably situations where these colonies can, in fact, be managed appropriately, where there are not wildlife around that the cats can damage, certainly not wildlife populations or populations of endangered or threatened species.
The debate over cat colonies is likely to grow, since some are located legally on public land. The controversy is more intense in other countries, specifically on island nations like Australia, where no or few ground predators ever existed, and cats had a field day. One senator there called for the eradication of all cats by 2020. The proposal was not taken seriously. To be fair, dogs are also considered somewhat of a menace to society. Their feces fouls stormwater, and they too are predators. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Hi, I'm your host, Peter Burley, and you're Talking Green on the Environment Show. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. And today we're talking about bugs. To some, they're creepy crawly things. To biologists and entomologists, they're probably the things that make nature work, from pollinating plants to disposing of waste. We have two guests with us, David George Gordon, whose new book is called The Complete Cockroach. He's a nature writer, and he lives in Port Townsend, Washington, with a group of about 40 Madagascan hissing cockroaches. And Steve Perkle, who is founder and director of the Sonora Arthropod Studies Institute in Tucson, Arizona. David Gordon, let's start with you. Why
Sure.
does someone live with pet Madagascan hissing cockroaches?
Well, you know, in the Northwest, where I live, cockroaches are kind of a novelty act. They're not the same as when I lived in Chicago or have visited New York, where they're everywhere. When I started working on my book, The Complete Cockroach, someone actually mailed me my cockroaches by Federal Express from Minnesota. And these guys are actually popular pets. I keep them in a nice 15-gallon aquarium with a tight-fitting top. There's a heater in there because they're tropical bugs, and they keep me company when I'm working late at night.
Okay. And what are cockroaches' role in the biological scheme of things?
Well, you know, the Madagascan hissing cockroaches are great reminders that not all cockroaches are pests. In fact, there's really only about, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and maybe 30 species of cockroaches worldwide that really plague people. keep in mind that there are actually 3,500 different kinds of cockroaches worldwide.
And you have seen each one of them, I trust.
I've seen as many as I can. When they're not out there pestering us in our homes, they perform a lot of important functions. And you mentioned a few in your introduction. Some are plant pollinators. If they were to disappear, probably the plants would go too. Cockroaches are also food for a whole array of animals, everything from really small creatures like predatory wasps, all the way up through snakes and frogs and toads and birds, up to ocelots and even humans. And probably most important of all, cockroaches are recyclers of dead plant and animal material in the forest. I've seen studies that show that they can consume about 6% of the yearly leaf fall in one part of the Amazon River basin.
Wow.
Yeah, that's important.
Steve Perkel, are cockroaches part of your activities in the Arthropod Institute?
Yes, the Northern Arthropod Studies Institute is an environmental education organization focusing on the arthropods that occur within the Sonoran Desert, which is a very rich area within the country. And we've got roaches here, some that are introduced pests, the pests that you find in the city. But we've got a roach that occurs here on our grounds, lives out in the desert, and instead of making its home in human kitchens, it does it in rodent burrows. And the females are flightless. The males have wings.
And what function, if we can say that, what role do they play in the ecosystem of the desert?
They're decomposers, feeding on rodent feces and bits of food that have been dropped in leaf litter. And since they are fossorial, digging down into the ground, they help loosen up topsoil so that plant roots breathe and seeds germinate easier.
Let's go to the phones. And Connell, I think you're in Tucson, are you? You're talking green in the Environment Show.
Okay, great. Yeah, I had a question about insects that eat cacti.
Sure.
They just don't look very edible to me, and I'm just wondering what types of insects eat cacti.
Okay, here in Dave, I assume you don't have very many cactus.
I don't have strong opinions on this subject. Living in the rainforest,
no cactus in the beautiful rainforest of the Northwest.
I'll go for that. Yeah. There's a number of longhorn beetles which eat cactus. There's one, the longhorn cactus beetle is the common name for it. It's a black flightless beetle you see most commonly during the summer months, and it tends to like the prickly pear and choya cactus. And then you'll find occasionally the black and orange longhorn beetle, which eats cactus fruit. You can see those, depending on the year, they go through some interesting cycles. Some years they're around when the saguaro fruit is ripe, and other times when prickly pear fruit is ripe. And then there's a moth whose caterpillar eats a variety of cactus as well.
And just following up on the question, is the activity of the insect important in the life cycle of the cactus, either for...
Not so much. It's not a close relationship like the yucca moth and the yucca, which serves as a pollinator and eats a few seeds, but is responsible for other seeds which mature. On these, they're just feeding on the fleshy material of the plants or on the fruit.
Gee, and I'm kind of curious how they're able to puncture those thick cactus skins.
They just chew in through them,
yeah.
Chewing mouthparts on beetles, and they just munch right into them.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. And do I understand that you have somebody with you? Connell, is Dana with you, who also had a question, I think?
Oh, yeah. Yes, she is.
Okay. Dana, you're talking green in the Environment Show.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. This is Dana.
Sure. What's your question?
I'm wanting to know if there's any kind of non-toxic methods of keeping insects out of your house. I'm allergic to all kinds of chemicals, but I live out in the desert and...
Okay, so you're another dry country person. We've heard about boric acid for cockroaches. What else is useful?
Well, you know, in my book, The Complete Cockroach, I talk a lot about modifying the environment. But before you do lay down anything, the first thing you should do is look at your home and ask why it's so attractive to bugs. And, you know, in the case of cockroaches, it's because you have heat and probably moisture in the form of maybe a leaky pipe or something, but also lots of cracks and crevices for them to hide. So even going around with cockroaches and sealing some of those cracks and crevices with caulk or masking tape or what have you will help a lot. A lot of times the insects that we find in our homes are actually ones that are moving into the home from outside when the environment gets tough for them. So looking for ways that they're getting in and out is probably a good start. And I think, well, you mentioned you have an allergy to insects, which would certainly make that a little more serious. There's also always going to be a certain level of life in your house. I think I'd be suspicious if there wasn't some form of life moving around besides you or me. So, you know, again, the notion isn't to completely eliminate, but to keep things in control.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
right.
Well, thanks for your call. Let me ask, let's get back to cockroaches for a moment.
Sure.
We don't have much time, and I know that a lot of people are familiar with cockroaches. How broad is their range worldwide? Are there cockroaches everywhere?
You know, because of our own travels, we've managed to spread cockroaches very far north and south. They're even in the steam tunnels in Fairbanks, Alaska, if you can imagine that. But traditionally or typically, their range really is in what we kind of call the banana belt. They're equatorial animals, and they really need heat and plenty of moisture. So, you know, once we start getting kind of out of the southern states in the U.S., the number of species diminishes.
So people who are concerned about cockroaches in their houses only have to shut off the heat if they live in the northern climes for a winter or two and shut off the water, and their problems are solved.
It was interesting. When I was researching my book, my initial thought was, boy, they must have really been a problem in the days of Victorian England, for example, the days before they invented those whopping pesticides. But I learned that actually a lot of homes were so poorly heated that they weren't a big problem. They actually hung around things like fireplaces, so that the heyday of cockroaches has only been more recently as we've been able to develop more pleasant homes.
Well, this is particularly good advice. I know that parts of the center of the country have just been clobbered with these cold spells.
That's right.
If you're renting a home and the heat goes off and you call up your landlord, he can simply say, listen, this is part of my cockroach control program, and you'll feel better. Okay, so basically what you're saying, I guess, is that at least within the American experience, to the extent that you find cockroaches in the colder parts of the world or the country, that's because they got there and then are living in our habitats and sharing them with us.
Well, for the most part, there are some native cockroach species. There's one that here in the Northwest is actually kind of an old-growth cockroach, if you will, lives in rotting tree stumps of old-growth forests. And it's a very termite-like cockroach. It's the one I was talking about that can actually digest cellulose and utilize the nutrients in that. That's a native. And there are a lot of native, what we call wood roaches.
Final question, our time runs out.
Sure.
You have both spoken about how these creatures play a very important role in consuming various forms of organic waste. You've described the fact that they chew it up and so on. That presumes that something then happens to it. They actually reduce its mass. Does their digestive process then reduce the bulk, or what happens to it after they eat it and digest it?
Well, it's just like the food that we eat. Yeah, it's digested, reduced in bulk, and goes back into the soil and then is continued to be broken down by various bacteria and microbes.
And so there are really massive amounts of bulk that go through these creatures as part of the working of our biological system. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah, especially things like leafcutter ants, which, like David was saying with the roaches as far as leaf litter, leafcutter ants are very important for taking in leaf litter. Termites, although they're a few species are destructive to houses, there's still many termites that are not pests. And they're all performing as decomposers, taking dead plant material and recycling it and building topsoil.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both. My guests have been David George Gordon, who is a nature writer and author of The Complete Cockroach, a book which all of you must read after having heard him, and Steve Perkle, who is founder and director of the Sonora Arthropod Studies Institute in Tucson, Arizona. We're talking Green on the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Let's hear from you. The tiny mountain kingdom of Bhutan is a model of environmental sustainability. That's according to Lee Talbot, senior professor in the Program in Environmental Science and Public Policy at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He traveled there on behalf of the government of Bhutan, the United Nations, and the Global Environment Facility to help develop a national biodiversity action plan. Bhutan hopes to avoid the development pressures which have ruined parts of the environment in some other Asian countries. Talbot says we can all learn a lesson from the Bhutanese.
Bhutan is a most remarkable country, and for a number of reasons. And it's probably the country that has the biodiversity most intact, certainly of any part of Asia, and one of the most, if not the most, anywhere in the world.
I think most of us think about rocky Himalayan peaks and interspersed with valleys. Is this a fair characterization?
Actually, it's a fairly charitable one from a topographic point of view. Bhutan is the most vertical country I have ever seen. The top part of it is rocks and Arctic, very, very high, cold country. And then as it runs down from there, there are a whole series of very steep valleys with magnificent forest cover virtually over the whole country except for the valley sides and valley bottoms where the rather small population lives. Population's only about 1.6 million at this stage.
And so what are the kinds of threats to biodiversity that are the most acute at this point?
Well, one threat is the population increase, of course, but the threats have been rather blunted or put off by what I regard as the extraordinary wisdom of the leadership of this country. Bhutan's absolutely unique in my experience of working in about 127 countries. Among other things, the leadership is an absolute monarchy with a government of a number of ministers and so forth. The king has stated and made it policy that gross national happiness is more important than gross national product.
That sounds like the only chief of state in the world that's ever said anything like that.
I'm convinced it is. Would that our country had that kind of wisdom. But it isn't just oratory. He's made it stick, and the government has. They, for example, have stopped most commercial logging, and they've stopped a great deal of exploitation of other living resources and natural resources there, pending their ability to do it in a sustainable way. What's happened is they've watched Nepal next door and India turn their countries into, lose most of the natural resources in terms of soil, forests, water, and so forth, wildlife. They've seen unlimited tourism do destructive things to the culture. And they've decided they don't want that to happen.
And so what sort of a plan do you hope to see put together to protect the biological diversity that you saw there?
The government's plan, or the plan that would be coming out of this, would involve both some of the traditional things like protected areas, and they have already set aside a very high percentage of their country, nearly 25%, as strictly protected areas. And then they want to manage the areas in between in a sustainable way, rather than, in effect, clear-cutting and losing it. They're trying to control all sorts of development, not the least of which is tourism. They're limiting tourists. They plan to limit tourists to a maximum of maybe 5,000 a year. And they're aiming for, in effect, high-end tourism so that they get the maximum income and benefit to the country from this.
The interesting thing about what you say is that our conventional wisdom is that we need to be pushing capitalism and democracy as a tenet of U.S. foreign policy. And what I think I hear you saying is here's a place that operates under neither of those theories, and it may be more sustainable than the folk that do.
Well, that certainly is my impression, and it does pose some really very interesting philosophical enigmas, doesn't it?
Lee Talbot, senior professor in the Program in Environmental Science and Public Policy at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, traveled to Bhutan as a consultant to develop a national biodiversity action plan. Waterfalls, rustling leaves, bird calls, and waves breaking on a shore are nature's music. Composers Priscilla and Barton McLean, known as the McLean Mix, take these sounds and incorporate them into their music. Their most recent release is called Rainforest Images, available on Capstone Records. Last week, they told us of a recent trip to the rainforest of Borneo, where cicadas filled the forest with noises unlike any they'd ever heard. Today, we air the second half of that interview with Environment Show producer Thomas Lally. But first, we hear a part of the composition which came for the trip. Most of the sound you'll hear will be made by cicadas.
I've heard cicadas. We have them here, of course, but not like these cicadas. They sing at dusk for 1 hour, and that is it. And the natives are afraid of them. They believe that these cicadas are the voices of their dead ancestors, and they stay away from any spot that they're singing. But the insects, the other cicadas also, there are many, many different kinds. They're just shrill, shrieking all day.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
And different ones in different places. I guess the insects are the most tremendous. The sound at 6 o'clock in the morning would just rise you out of your cot about half a foot.
We did actually in one place on the Yulong River, Yulong Ai River. We were literally raised out of our sleeping by this one cicada that made the most unbelievable loud sound I've ever heard. I mean, much more loud than any bird I've ever heard. Just unbelievable sound.
Right. I would say that one of the biggest differences is there's more insect sounds and less bird sounds.
Right.
And I think the reason is the insects drown out the birds.
Mm. Yeah. And it's continuous all day long, and it changes from hour to hour. It's like listening to a 12-hour symphony.
And so you had never heard this before. I mean, this differs significantly from
other
rainforests?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Very significant.
Although every rainforest I've ever been in around the world is different from every other rainforest.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, radically different. So the Australian rainforest is extremely different from New Zealand rainforest, which is totally different from the Borneo rainforest. So I assume that they're all quite different. But this one has the most powerful strident sounds I've heard.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 374. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer. And Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and the Packard Foundation. Also, Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.